Hello, everybody. This is Josh Blaser from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast, where we examine the art and science of games. We are officially in summer now. I'm sure everyone listening, and as well as us, are just sweating it out. It's that summer droll of games, but there's still a lot of great topics to talk about. First, please welcome back to the cast my friend, as well as intern slash contributor to GameWisdom, James Ellerby.
Hi, guys. As I said, I'm the intern.
Yep, I know you're also on the East Coast with me. I'm sure you're sweating horribly as well.
Oh, yeah.
Good day.
And please welcome to the cast first-time guest, game designer Michael Taylor.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Mike. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Same here.
All right. So we're going to get going. I guess we'll just talk some general stuff. We have a few great topics to talk about tonight. But first, Mike, since this is your first time on the cast, for the people listening, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, like the kind of games you like to play and stuff like that?
No problem. I'm currently a game designer slash programmer trying to get his foot in the door right now. But, the kind of games I play, being a designer, I can't dismiss anything, so I have to sit through a lot of not so great games, but preferably I like to play RPGs and story-focused games.
Mm-hmm. And I know in the email that we were talking about, you really liked the post I made. For those of you listening to this cast, it should be about, 2 weeks since it went up, regarding issues of where storytelling falls apart or breaks down for a lot of video games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And video game storytelling is definitely an interesting part, and it really has been something that has evolved with the medium. We're seeing, again, I get to date myself. I remember back in the day where pretty much the oldest story we got was your princess is in another castle. That was it. That's all we needed.
Or if it wasn't that, it was like, asteroids are coming, shoot them down, or missiles, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And video game storytelling is definitely one of the aspects that has really pushed the art side of game development outward. We are especially seeing this from independent developers, such as The Chinese Room, Frictional Games, titles like Dear Esther, Gone Home, and even stuff like we saw even with like action-based games like Braid or Portal, and of course The Last of Us. These are games with a strong gameplay component, but also have unique stories and are trying to motivate you to play it that way. So I guess a question for both of you then, in terms of like video game storytelling, what are some games that you found particularly well done in terms of their story? And we'll start with you, James.
One of my personal favorites is an old PS1 title that they remade for the PlayStation. Let's see if everybody remembers the not Vita.
The PlayStation Portable?
Portable, PSP, yeah. It's portable. Is Final Fantasy Tactics. And I'd have to say, I mean, yeah, the Final Fantasies all have good stories, but a lot of the stories I'd say Final Fantasies in the traditional sense, mm-hmm, are so, when you look back at them, you realize, oh wow, this is just the hero tale, mm-hmm, told. How many, what are we at now? Final Fantasy 15?
15.
Oh yeah, the hero tale told. Yeah. The hero's tale told 15 times with, mm-hmm, different haired people with different hair.
And different lengths of swords, don't forget
different
that.
Lengths of swords. While Final Fantasy Tactics really really made a lot of push towards things that have happened in European society, and made a lot of pushes against the church, asked a lot of questions, made you wonder what you were doing, who you really were in the whole grand scheme of things, where you, and then I give a little bit of a spoiler. If you haven't played it, please go out and play it. It still won't be a spoiler because of just once you get into the game, you won't realize anything I've said. But you realize in the very end, you weren't the main character the entire time, which was one of the first times I ever saw a game like that. And I followed, as a kid, it brought a new level of storytelling to me for someone that's grown up with like that, those traditional hero roles. It was one of the first games story-wise that made me question what it means to be a hero and why. Now, it still had a lot of the basic tropes, but it turned certain things on its head and made me question a lot of things. So story-wise, I probably say that was probably the first game that really made me interested and really care about what was going on. Mm-hmm. Character-wise and stuff, and the world and as a whole.
Yeah. James, have you ever played Tactics Ogre that came out on the PSP?
Yes, I have played Tactics Ogre. But it's weird to say this. I played the Tactics Ogre that came out for the Game Boy Advance.
Mm-hmm.
I beat it, and I loved it. I had, same thing. I really put that up. But keep in mind, I had played up obviously Tactics first.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I have played the Tactics Ogre series, and that really offered a lot of that as well.
Yeah, I really liked the PSP Tactics Ogre. It was, I think, a re-release of an earlier game that came out. I don't know if it ever came out in the U.S., but I know it was obviously from Japan. It had a really great story. Again, dealing with more themes about like war and, you know, who's really on the winning side or who's really the hero when it comes to warfare. And again, those are stories we typically don't see from video game developers. And there's probably a podcast in there about talking about, you know, the depiction of war in video games. We may have to write that down and come back to that in its own cast.
Definitely a podcast. Yeah.
For you, Michael, what are some great storytelling examples do you have?
Well, it's funny that it shows a Final Fantasy because mine's also a Final Fantasy. But for me specifically, it's Final Fantasy X, flaws and all. Mm-hmm. Like hair, main character stuff, and stuff like that. But what really got me personally is how it dealt with religion in a few spots. Mm-hmm. Because I come from a background where my relationship with religion is timid at best. And of course you're stomping at the church's doors at the end, but to this day I haven't seen a story arc of a character who has to wrestle with his own beliefs and faith and stuff like that, and of course the whole symbolism throughout the whole story of everyone's collected sins into this monster, and it's just an endless repeating cycle, and how it's it takes influences from actual pilgrimages, from the Crusades and all that. So,
oh, okay,
yeah. And it's kind of interesting about like both of you having Final Fantasy games as some of your great storytelling options, because again, the series has been saying it's the Final Fantasy for, at this point, I guess it's going to be over 20 years.
That's a really age-old joke right there.
But it's kind of interesting about how they keep changing and really putting different stories together. Like, for instance, we could talk about Final Fantasy VI or Final Fantasy III.
Oh, yes.
As another really fantastic example. And for like one of like the first or only games I can think of where you technically lose, like halfway through the game, the world gets destroyed.
Yep.
And you can. Yep.
And to put up another example, Square Enix has a big hit with 7, and by that time, 8's probably like halfway done, and they decided to change things up from all the other stories and try to do a. legitimate relationship building part of this story between Squall and Rhea Noah and stuff like that.
Yeah. And
then again, that game has tons of problems, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really liked Final Fantasy, I think it was 12. I think that was like the one that's considered somewhat controversial for all the changes they did.
Yeah, it is.
And I'll be honest, the only reason I played Final Fantasy XII was because I heard everyone, all the Final Fantasy fans hated that one. That's what drove, that what got me to play that one, because that was during the era where I pretty much gave up on most JRPGs. I think that was still like early thousands. It wasn't until I started playing more of the Shin Megami Tensei games and the RPGs from Atlas that sort of slowly but surely won me back as a fan there.
Boy, those games are time sinks.
Oh, yes. I mean, the Skya games, like any game from Nippon Ichi, that's a good like 80 to 100 hours easy if you want to get in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
still can't beat the freaking final boss of Persona 3. It's so freaking hard.
Yeah.
I've actually never played any of the Persona games. Really? Much to
do it.
A lot of my friends are huge Persona fans. They're like, what? You've never played them? Like, I never could find them. I just didn't really know too much about them when I was a kid.
Considering how most of them don't have an HD collection, they're probably rare and expensive by now.
The thing with Atlas, and this is another one of those weird things about how the industry was like 15 years ago during the 2000s. And Atlas at that time was very, very, very niche. It was a company where the whole GameStop model of, you know, if you don't pre-order it, you're not going to get it, really did apply to them. Atlas basically built themselves up as a company that released very limited runs of their games. But at the same time, it meant that they really didn't have as much risk compared to like a AAA studio who, you know, they need 5-6 million copies to sell. They can make a success with a fraction of that. But the problem, though, if you miss that initial run, good freaking luck getting one of those games. For instance,
I was lucky enough to find a used copy of the Persona 4 with the soundtrack at a GameStop for like $20 when I was 17. Yeah.
And I got lucky finding a copy of Nocturne, the original, the Shin Megami Tensei Nocturne.
Me too.
Yeah, like one day I was like walking into a GameStop, I saw there, I was like, oh my god! Like, hold on to that. I get my credit card. Don't sell that. I need that. But
and that game's stupidly unfairly hard.
Oh yes, and that's another hour discussion right there. But getting back to Atlas and like the Persona series, it was really like Persona 3. I think was like the first like real mainstream game from Atlas, like the first one to really like open up the door something. They have done publishing in the past. I think they were either one of the original publishers or took it over when Nippon Ichi. They originally published a Skya and then Nippon Ichi basically started their own publishing firm after that. And Persona 4, I think, is considered probably one of the better games. I think it's the most accessible of the Shin Megami Tensei games at the moment.
Yeah, yes, it definitely is.
And that would be the one, if you haven't played any SMT game, James, I would say that would be a really good one to start with. Because, as Michael and I were talking about, the older ones are just stupidly difficult. They are very hard games. They really play the RPG mechanics up. Like, if you don't master their systems, you're not going to get, like, 30 minutes into them kind of thing.
Well, and if you can actually beat those games without using a walkthrough or a strategy guide, I salute you, man.
Yeah, I think...
because I can't freaking do it.
The only ones I've actually managed to beat, I think, was Persona 4 and... oh, and the Shin Megami Tensei 4 that came out on the 3DS recently. I think those are the...
I have not played that. I need to.
What's the difference between Shin Megami Tensei and Persona? Are they the same game? Or?
It's one of those weird... it's like sort of like the Japanese anime convention where you have like the main story and then you have like side stories of characters.
And the Persona games are side games. I mean, like, the full title is Shin Megami Tensei Persona 4. Yeah. And
okay, all right.
And then if you have the updated version, Shin Megami Tensei Persona 4 The Golden.
Yeah, and these are the games where if you have allergies, you will start choking if you try to say their whole title in, like, one breath.
I forgot into them as a kid. I didn't know which one was which.
Yeah, the Persona games, again, like Michael said, they're these side stories. They all share similar RPG mechanics, but there are major differences. Like, the Persona games typically take place in, like, modern day era, more of like a social aspect to
social
them.
Social links and all that.
Yeah, and the Shin Megami Tensei games more or less follow, like, sort of like the Final Fantasy tradition, that each game is essentially its own beast, its own story, its own location, stuff like that.
Except it's on Dark Souls difficulty.
Yeah, pretty much. getting back to the original topic, talking more about storytelling, some of my favorite games, I think that I'm glad you just mentioned Dark Souls, so that's probably a good example of some of the games I've enjoyed story-wise.
That game's a masterclass of telling you the story without actually telling you.
Yes, and in my piece I talked about, like, cinematic games, like, the Souls series is such an outlier in terms of their storytelling. As you just said, it's a game that there's a story, but it doesn't tell you the story. There's never, like, a cutscene that breaks it down. A few months ago, I spoke with my friend who's a huge Dark Souls fan. We spent 2.5 hours talking about Dark Souls 3, and we barely scratched the surface of the story.
That's something I would probably have a little bit of a grievance with. Mm-hmm. And I'm a huge Dark Souls fan, mm-hmm. actually. I told you I was shedding a tear because I missed that podcast. Because I also it was good because I haven't played Dark Souls 3 yet. Mm-hmm. Huge fan of Dark Souls and love it. But here's one of my grievances: the very fact that it doesn't tell you the story, and it's not even that it's a bad grievance. Mm-hmm. The very fact that Souls only really tells you a story through, like, item descriptions and your own exploration of the world, I'd almost beg to reason that the story comes more from the fan base and outside of the game than it does even within the game.
I could see that. I mean, me and some of my other developer friends are constantly debates, like, should story be made and chosen by the players of what we give them, or actually work our damnedest to make memorable characters that are crafted for them, or whatever,
and,
you know?
And, like, the Souls games, again, they're such an exception to most rules, especially in both in terms of storytelling and design. I mean, the Souls games practically demand you to have a high skill to get into. There is no hand-holding. There are no difficulty levels. There's nothing that's going to make the game, quote-unquote, easier for you. You start suffering.
Mage build's overpowered. Mage build is overpowered. Arrows for the win. Arrows for the win.
I was on the verge of tears when I got to the Bell Gargoyles.
Oh, yes.
So awful.
Oh, yeah. And before this turns into Dark Souls Guess the sequel, it is, like, in terms of its storytelling, again, I can see your point, James, about that. Like, when you put next to other, like, story focus or games that are driven by a narrative, stuff like Mass Effect or The Last of Us, or even some examples we mentioned earlier, like Dear Esther and Gone Home, it's not, like, a story that the developers are really, like, focusing on. Like, you can play those games, and you don't even need to know what's going on, essentially. You can just say, oh, here's some guys fighting in a room. Who the hell cares? They're trying to kill me. Let's go. But if you want to explore that, you know, there's probably like a 3-4 hour history lesson on who these characters are and what they do. And it is very debatable whether or not that's an example of good storytelling or not. For myself, some of the games that I've really enjoyed story-wise definitely run that very weird gambit. For instance, one game that I really liked was Killer 7 from a few years ago.
Oh, yes.
Hell yes.
And Killer 7, for those of you listening who don't know, developed by Goichi Suda, or as he's commonly known in the US, Suda 51. Very Killer Sim is one of those games that it's very hard to describe. And again, that's an hour and a half discussion on what makes Killer 7 unique.
It's in that weird gonzo genre blending kind of sphere.
Yep, and I really, it's one of those games that, again, it gives you such a unique world, unique characters, and then asks you, you know, what do you think about this? And it's pretty much the game that I think has elevated Suda51, and it's also a game that's sort of been like his chain. Like, he hasn't been able to escape Killer 7, all the games he's made after that, because it was such a unique title.
I'm still holding out hopeful for the next great Suda51 game.
Yeah.
I really am. Mm-hmm. If ever since,
Now, another game that I really liked, and this is a one that, for those of you who listened to this cast, like, way back during the first year, you probably heard me mention this, but I don't think I brought it up too recently, would be Rule of Rose. Have either of you played that game?
I have seen it on sale for $100, but I know nothing about it.
I've never heard of it, actually.
Oh, good. So now I get to have a good 20-minute discussion. Rule of Rose is a PlayStation 2 survival horror game, and it dealt with a lot of very dark and mature themes involving children. You play this woman who gets basically abducted at an orphanage and forced to play games with sadistic children who are basically torturing her throughout this entire process.
So it's kind of like Saw if Jigsaw were children?
Yeah, sort of like that. It's one of those games that it's... I'm sorry, what was that?
Silent Hill with more babies?
Yeah, almost like that. Like, every chapter is basically the... Yeah, that's actually a really good description. Like, the first half of every chapter, you're in, like, the orphanage, and the kids are being mean to you and basically torturing you. And then the second half, you're on a zeppelin while strange kids or animal hybrids, they don't really explain, try and kill you. And
sorry, go on.
And it's just like, and you have a pet dog who helps you, too.
Yeah, okay, the Saw may not have been the best description. From what you're telling me, that this reminds me a lot of Harlan Ellison's I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
Oh, yeah. I need to read that at some point. I bought the game, too. Maybe I'll someday fire that up.
The game is really good, mm-hmm. well told, and you need a walkthrough to get through it.
I heard that, too.
And the actual like short story, it's like a 30-minute breezy read.
Yeah.
It's really good, too.
And with Rule of Rose, like, it's one of those games that talks about, like, sort of like the dark innocence of children. Like, they think they're just playing these cute little games. But, like, it gets, like, some really heavy stuff. And, of course, it has... I'm trying to talk about that, like, outright spoiling, which is really hard. But, like, there's a... The ending is just... brutal. That's all I'm going to say about how it ends.
So like, it's very emotionally draining.
Yeah. It's also hearing draining, because they have, I mentioned this before, it has this battle music, which is just like this, like, three or four same notes of a violin repeated for, like, as long as you're in battle. Like, during, like, the main game, it's okay, because battles only last maybe 2-3 minutes. And then the second-to-last chapter is literally, like, a 30-minute battle section. So you just hear, like, the same 5 or 6 notes repeated over and over for, like, 30 minutes. And, like, by the end of it, my ears are starting to bleed from that.
Do you theorize that might be an intentional decision?
It gets, like, it has, like, the same kind of issues with, like, blurring the lines between fantasy and reality. But the point that I want to bring up, and what I really found very interesting about the story, this is sort of a half-spoiler, I guess, but the final, once you've been in the game, I guess, quote-unquote, the final chapters is essentially an epilogue with you exploring the entire area, like, everywhere that the game took place in. And basically, she's revealing about what all this stuff really happened, what it really meant to her. It was almost like the precursor to Gone Home, in a sense, before Gone Home was even a thing.
Mm.
And I thought that was just, like, very well done. Like, there's no combat whatsoever. You're free to go about your own pace. And it's just you basically, I guess, getting, like, her final thoughts on everything that just happened in the entire game. And I've never seen another game go that way before in terms of, like, sort of tying a ribbon on the whole experience. I guess the other example that I want to bring up, I think, would be like Telltale Games. I think they've really gotten good in terms of their storytelling and adventure gameplay.
Yes.
Oh boy, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure everyone listening, and I bet you guys have definitely played like The Walking Dead or at least seen footage of it by now.
Well, it's the game that put their name on yes. the map.
I actually played the I never played the Walking Dead games. I've heard of them, obviously, but I played the Borderlands series games.
Yeah.
But I actually enjoyed.
Have either of you played The Wolf Among Us yet?
Yeah, huh?
Oh, yeah. I really liked that. I think that may be my favorite game from Telltale, at least right now. I know, as of this time of recording, they are currently working on a Batman game.
Yes, I just saw that. It looks very good. So perfect for them.
Yeah, and so I can't wait to try that one out. But with Telltale and their storytelling, it's really interesting to see how they've evolved over the last decade. Again, they originally started making like Law and Order games and poker titles.
And also Bone.
Yeah. And then they sort of got their first like push into the spotlight with Sam and Max, and that was like originally like a GameTap exclusive or something like that. Like that program that like died already, like, only lasts like a year or something like that.
Well, and the original Sam and Max games were stupefyingly hard to figure out.
And then from Sam and Max, they sort of did their own like the Universal era. I think was sort of like their low point. I know a lot of people didn't like Back to the Future. I heard really bad things about Jurassic Park, the game.
Yeah.
And then, again, The Walking Dead was sort of like, that was pretty much, I think, their studio-defying moment. I think that's sort of where they drew the line in the sand about the kind of games you're going to expect from them. And actually brings me to a really interesting question I want to ask both of you. In terms of Telltale, one of the things I think has really divided some of their fan base, including myself, is how they really have walked away from the quote-unquote adventure side of things. If you notice from like the Sam & Max era to where we're at now with like Borderlands, Wolf Among Us, and obviously with Batman and such, they really have moved away from puzzle solving or quote-unquote gameplay of the adventure genre. Instead, it's been sort of pushed into the background in favor of, again, telling more involving stories. The Walking Dead, I think, being one of the most critically received games for a very long time. So my question for both of you, and we'll start with Michael this time, is what do you think of sort of this transition from adventure game to more of a storytelling from Telltale?
Well, surprise, surprise. I've in the long run, I don't mind, but if the way I see it, it's kind of where the whole industry itself is kind of in like this whole transition of big bright ideas, both in concept and technology and stuff like that, and we're kind of at the point where Hollywood was in the early 70s when the financial studios collapsed and they were desperate for any talent to get them out of the rut they're in, and you got some great stuff, some mediocre stuff, and some polarizing stuff. But I kind of have the feeling a couple decades from now the future up and coming game designers who are forced to research these games are probably not going to be debating the questions that we're debating now.
Yeah. And I think you're right about that. Sort of like how things have really transitioned. We've seen the game industry in the past has really pushed, like, whenever there's a popular game or popular trend, it will usually all corners of will push hard in that direction. We saw this with platformers, first-person shooters, and go ahead.
Well, and especially since our compared to most industries, our industry moves faster than all of them.
Definitely.
Like who the hell would have thought that Pokemon Go would be the augmented reality killer app, you know?
Yeah. Mm. And again, like even over like the last decade with Steam and all the stuff we've talked about multiple times on these casts, I mean, in 10 years, the industry just completely redefined itself and pretty much changed in ways no one thought was possible. I mean, you can probably have a drinking game. How many times I've said this on this cast, but we all talk about how great Steam is. I'm sure everyone listening to this cast is using it. But in 2004, everyone, including myself, was going, this is never going to work. No one's going to want this Steam on their computer.
Sucks.
Yes. And now look where we're at today.
Yeah.
Now, for you, James, we're going back to the Telltale question. What do you think about sort of that divide between adventure and storytelling?
I personally think there's I guess I kind of want to answer that with my own question. And it's, at what point are you just a visual novel instead of being a game?
Mm.
And I'm not saying that that's bad or, you know, bad or good, just as far as the definition goes, I think that's something that Telltale is going to have to watch for themselves, you know what I mean? Because I have heard talk around the gaming community that say that that Telltale aren't really moving out of becoming actual gamers. I don't know if I'd go that far to say that, because there are still... You know, but a game by definition still has to be interactive.
Mm-hmm.
And when you lose that interactivity, is it really a game? You know, there's people that were fighting. I had a couple of friends that didn't think that Gone Home was really a game. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, we just look around. There's no, what am I doing? Is this just a game? Is this a game or just kind of an interactive experience?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that the industry is going to have to define itself too.
Yeah.
I'm going to be pulling this from a old extra credits episode back in like 2009 or whatever, where like games might need something like how comic books did from when they were just called comic books, and then they got the fancy name of graphic novels when Watchmen came out. But you know, interactive experiences doesn't sound as fancy as a graphic novel, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point, James, about sort of like that definition. Again, that's another one of those topics that we're still struggling with. I mean, over the last year or so, there's been, of course, the argument over, do we still call people gamers? Or trying to put like labels and titles on things has never been a strong suit, I think, for the industry. Like, I mean, hell, we still have people arguing over, is Metroidvania a genre? Do we call a game Souls-like now? And those are probably hour-long discussions apiece, I think.
Yeah. Only in the game industry they have discussions like that.
Yeah. And what you just said, James, regarding visual novels, I think another developer that has sort of been skirting that line would be like David Cage and the games that he makes, stuff like Indigo Prophecy, the game that was just announced at, I think, Sony's convention. I don't remember the name, though, off the top of my head.
It was Chicago, I think.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, his games are another really good example of sort of like that line between game and visual novel. Their games are really defined by all the permutations and choices that you have, and then seeing sort of where all that stuff ends up with. And it seems like, to me, like that's sort of like like the evolved version of what Telltale is trying to do with their games. And I don't think Telltale has quite gotten there yet. I mean, even though I really like the story of The Walking Dead and The Wolf Among Us, they're not really games that lend themselves to these multiple stories or multiple ways of going through them. I think part of that, of course, is the fact that they're working on existing IPs. They can't, you know, take... like with Batman, they're not going to take Batman and say, oh, we're going to move him, you know, to the beach for the next game. That's never going to happen. So they're
Unless Bruce Wayne finally got over his parents and grows up, but that's a comic Bruce book Wayne. Exception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would love, I've said this before in the past, but I would love for Telltale to actually create their own IP, something that they control 100%, and let them just do whatever the hell they want with it. And, like, maybe truly make that choose-your-own-adventure that I think is sort of, like, in, like, that you can sort of, like, see trying to get out of their titles.
Wolf Among Us isn't that? That's not Telltale?
No, it doesn't hit. It gets close, but it doesn't get there. Like, again, it still has a locked ending that's going to be the same no matter what you do. Now, there's one last example of storytelling that I think I would be remiss not to bring up here, and then we'll move on to our next topic, which may be our final topic, but we'll see. And that will, of course, be the Metal Gear Solid series. I think in a discussion about storytelling in video games, you have to bring up Metal Gear Solid. It's one of those things, like, I've talked about this before, but Hideo Kojima was really one of the first developers to explore cinematography, I think, in video games.
I remember that was one of your points in that article I read of how a lot of games don't take advantage of camera angles and composition.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep, and that was one of the things, like, when I first played, like, Metal Gear Solid for the first time, wow, like, very, very long time ago, it was, like, so interesting to see a game actually explore, like, how much the camera can add to things, where it's showing characters at different angles, displaying information, trying to set the player up for things. And again, it's one of the things that a lot of developers really don't do. In my article, I basically said that a lot of RPG developers basically just copy BioWare, which is, you know, the same two still shots of the characters talking, and they just...
The stone unblinking face.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
And that just drives me up a wall, because it doesn't, like, I don't want to listen to, like, two guys just staring, like, blankly into space for 5 minutes talking. It just, like, bores the hell out of me.
You mean Zack Snyder's Batman v Superman?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Zack Snyder's Batman v Superman had a lot of that, too.
Yeah, and one example that I didn't mention in the article that I kind of feel sorry that I didn't bring up would sort of be like what they did with, like, Rockstar Studios, I think would be another example of, like, trying to explore more of the cinematic aspect with their games. Now, whether that cinematic actually fits the gameplay they're talking about is another story, but they are another example of a developer who tries to get, you know, an actual, like, sense of scope or cinematography with their cutscenes.
And boy, do they try.
Yes. I didn't play L.A. Noire, but I heard, like, from a storytelling, like, sort of like an acting perspective, that a lot of people liked it from that point of view.
Yeah. My brother was super into it when it came out, mm-hmm. a few years ago, but as much as I like how different it is from the norm, and plus being a cinephile, I gobble up the setting,
mm-hmm.
but it's, oh boy, it's so slow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's also, I think, a really good point you just said, Michael. And I think that's one of the things that's also, like, pushing back regarding storytelling in games is the fact that at the end of the day, we're still playing video games. And this goes back to what you said a few minutes ago, James, regarding defining it, whether it's a game or a visual novel. Like, and even with the Souls series, like, most people, if you're going to play a video game, you're not going to be interested in sitting through, you know, 10, 15 minutes worth of cutscenes and discussions. You want to see how the game is actually played. But it's a different feel for when you're going to sit and watch a 2-hour movie or a 30-minute to an hour long show. And I think that kind of pacing is one area where a lot of video games, or where the video game industry in general, has definitely struggled with trying to appeal to the more cinematic side of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's also why the Soul series was smart in hiding a lot of their story, because imagine if they did have, like, 5 to 10 minute cutscenes, like, before or after each fight. It would just completely break that mood of the game.
Yeah, very much so.
And, I mean, this is, again, one of those topics we could talk who knows how long about. But
it could be another cast onto itself.
Yeah. I think to wrap up this section, then, we'll go once again around sort of like our little virtual table, then. What's an example of a game where the story or the storytelling failed for you? And this time, we will start with Michael.
Where it failed for me? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be at the very end, or can it be at, like, at any point?
Any point is good.
Well, I was super, super, super into the Condemned series.
Mm.
From, like, have you played those?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah, please no, that was a teenager. Mm. I love the blend, but then it all peered apart at number two specifically. Yeah. And it kind of went full on Indigo Prophecy, mm-hmm, or Fahrenheit. Maybe.
Yeah, and...
And that's an example of a lot of games, but yeah, it's sad.
Yeah, and what Michael was talking about, for those of you who haven't played them, the Condemned series started out as sort of like a gritty murder mystery kind of thing. You're basically hunting serial killers in like the most decrepit places around. Basically, it's first-person bum fights. I think that's what a lot of people describe it as. And it was really good. It really managed to combine action with horror. And I really loved the first one.
And that's a very tightrope to walk on.
Yeah.
Where, like where most long-running horror series most of the time you are stuck with a monster and then you kill the monster or whatever, you run out of ideas and then you turn into Resident Evil 6, but whatever.
Yes. Or Friday the 13th, where you kill Jason, then he comes back, and then you go 2,000 years into the future.
Jason takes Manhattan, and then Jason goes to hell, and now he goes to space.
Yes. And I think, as a quick tangent, a lot of the horror movies did go into space. Like, Hellraiser went into space, Leprechaun.
Freaking Leprechaun.
Yes, went to space. That makes, like, no sense.
And then, but after he went to space, he went to the hood, yes, and then went back to the hood.
Yeah, for reasons I think none of us will ever really know.
or care.
Yeah. And I just completely lost my train of thought with that. What was I just saying?
Leprechaun Back to the Hood will do that.
We were talking about the Condemned series, oh, yes, and you were going into more detail of how.
And then we somehow got to leprechauns and that. But with Condemned, what happened was, like, the first game kept it very much based in reality. Like, there was hallucinations, there were things that you weren't sure were real, but it still kept with everything being, like, grounded in a sense of trying to hunt down these serial killers, what makes them tick, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then the second game, as Michael said, it went basically full-on Indigo Prophecy with shadowy cults. You're apparently the chosen one with the voice that can kill people. Apparently, all the serial killers are being driven by strange machines that are making people go insane. At one point, you fight, like, a 10-foot-tall guy covered in junk who is apparently like a giant ogre in a trash yard, which makes, like, no sense. And it just got, like, it went so over the top that it completely lost, like, the message of the first game.
It definitely went more action-y.
Mm-hmm.
More Resident Evil 6.
Yeah.
Before Resident Evil 6 came out.
Oh, yes. And I guess moving on, for you, James, what are some examples of stories that failed for you?
Two stories in particular, I'd have to say. Mm-hmm. The first one being Borderlands 1.
Mm.
And the reason I say that is because I felt like I was really let... Me and a good friend of mine, I was telling him about the series and how much fun it is and the little stories here and there. They threw a lot of tributes into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd never beaten the game. So me and a friend who had never played it before restarted the whole game over and drilled through the entire game and got to the final boss, and it literally was big tentacle monster, kill it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, obviously, and they basically, the game basically replied back with, oh, okay, sorry, nothing else to do now.
Yeah.
And the lead up to all of it was literally telling you, you have to do this to achieve this, you have to do this to achieve this, you have to do this to achieve this. And you got to the very end, and it was the most unsatisfactory ending, like, ever. It was just like, I almost apologized to my friend. I was like, God, dude, I thought the ending would have been a lot better. I apologize about this. And you know, the experience of the gameplay held together a good percentage of the experience for mm-hmm. us, but the ending and the getting to the endings, what I go back now being a little bit wiser in video games, and I look at the journey that it took, and there really was no story. It was mm-hmm. do this mission to get to the next mission, do this mission to get to the next mission. And there wasn't anything, there was no substance to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, great gameplay, but no story to really tie it together.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about the Borderlands series for me. Like, it feels like they do better with, like, the characters and the smaller plots than they yes. do with, like, the actual main thing. Like, I was really into, like, sort of, like, the whole Handsome Jack downfall in the pre-sequel. Yep. Or,
number two?
No, there was a... Wait, am I thinking of the right thing? It was Borderlands 2, and then there was the Borderlands games, and then there, I mean, from Telltale, then there was the pre-sequel, I think. It was so that one, like, sort of like seeing his downfall in that one.
Well, okay, so, and something I really enjoy about, Gearbox?
Yeah.
Gearbox did Borderlands. What I really loved is they listened to all the fans mm-hmm. after the first game when they told them, look, your story sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And they quickly remedied with a bunch of DLC. Mm-hmm. People doing more stuff and add a little bit more to the world. But then when they made Borderlands 2, there was an actual story keeping things together. Now, it was basically like a Saturday morning anime cartoon story, but still a fun, entertaining story. And some of
them... Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, and believe it or not, the pre-sequel is the child, the brainchild of number two, of Borderlands 2. You don't understand Handsome Jack until you play Borderlands 2 and realize, I mean, and go through that whole narrative, because he is a beautifully written villain. Yeah. Like, he would fit perfectly in a Batman world.
Mm-hmm.
Batman of a great villain, I think he is.
Yep, and like, all the characters that they make in these games, they're characters you generally want to follow or see what's going on. Like, Tiny Tina was like a revelation of how great she was. Mr. Torque.
Mr. Torque, great character.
And like, even like, and again, even like with like the main characters, they gave them like some level of personality. Like, they seem really good with, again, these like smaller stories, but they just seem to have trouble with trying to make a story that goes from, you know, beginning to end.
Uh-huh. A full narrative.
Yeah.
And even more trouble with stuff that isn't their own IP.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like the Alien Colonial Marine insanity.
Oh, come on. Well, we're having a big conversation here.
Like, I'll give you one other good example for Borderlands, and then we'll go to your other example. Like the Psycho, who they introduced in Borderlands, to the one who became playable. Like, I really...
Krieg,
yeah. Like, they have this whole thing of him, like, trying to... Like, if you play with him, you get to, like, hear, like, his, like, rational side. Like, the first time I played, like, who the hell is talking? Like, I didn't realize it's a lair. That's, like, his own, like, voice in his head.
His rational side is his inner voice.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was great.
And, like, that's, like, a really good example, like, of a well-defined character. And, like, the Borderlands series is just full of those types of characters. But I just don't see... But, like, none of it really fits, I think, within the space of a game. Like, I would watch, like, an animated series or something, like, or, like, a little movie of these characters. Like, the same way that I would do with, like, the Team Fortress guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
And it's sort of like the opposite problem of like Team Fortress, where the story has like zero bearing on the gameplay, while Borderlands tries to sort of shoehorn the story in, and it doesn't really work with this kind of game.
Yeah.
What's your other example, James?
My other example was a Capcom title called Dragon's Dogma.
I've heard of it, but yeah. I don't think I played it.
Michael, have you played it?
I played it briefly. I've only played like 4 hours of it, but I've heard like several other stories from my friends.
I've beaten Dragon's Dogma all the way through both the game and its DLC, and it is this beautiful Tolkien-esque fantasy world. The gameplay is phenomenal. It's like advanced Monster Hunter action, fantasy. The everything is beautiful about it.
But
tell me what the hell is going on in the story, I will give you an award. I mean, now it does tell you, it gives you cutscenes, but there's no. It's literally big cutscene. That's your motivation, and then. Nothing.
So there's barely any tissue in there.
There's no. You have two slices of really fine French bread, and nothing, no meat or cheese or lettuce or tomato in the middle. As far as story wise goes, it's beautiful motivation in the beginning. They wrap it up beautifully at the end, but you don't really realize how you got to the end as of. Follow this arrow to go here. I mean, you're having a blast while you're doing it, but it is that was one of the biggest storyline fall throughs I've had in recent years, where it was just again, gorgeous game. Play it again for the actual gameplay, but storyline wise, there's characters in it. They're kind of bland and two-dimensional. Your character, you kind of know his motive. You know his motivation from the beginning, the first 15 minutes. Basically, a dragon shows up, steals your heart, and you have to go find out why? Maybe? That's even describing it is like, there's almost no possible way to ruin the story because that's how, disassembled and broken it is.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, now I have to play it.
Yes. Oh, yes. Please play it. If anything, like I said, the customization is reminding of the old school. It is one of the best updated D&D play styles you're ever going to see. Because you don't really get partners, storyline characters that go with you as partners. You get these other things called pawns. These people, they're kind of, don't even get me started on what they actually are, because the game doesn't really even go into a full-on explanation of who they are. They're your other party members. One of them you can completely customize on the Atlas level. You know, skills, you basically level them up as much as you can, but only the two of them. Only yourself and your first pawn that you create in the beginning. Can you actually create? And you can bounce back and forth between different classes. You have those classic rogues, warriors, you know, mages. You have the classic rogue, warrior, mage. It's action combat, but the gameplay is fluid and smooth. It's so dynamic. It's a beautiful Capcom game. And yeah, they just drop the ball when it comes to story. Yeah, it was one of those, look at these pretty colors. What's the story? Look at these pretty colors.
Well, and to be fair, Capcom has never been strong with story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, even like for instance, like the Dead Rising series has also struggled with that, trying to be serious or being humorous, and then having like the character be completely different. Like the second game, Chuck Green was like such a horrible protagonist for that kind of game.
And here he is wearing lingerie and fooling around killing zombies with a lawnmower.
Yeah. Or bombs made out of meat. Like, it makes no sense. And
that's why I always go back to the Dead Rising 1, where it knows exactly what it is.
Yeah. Speaking about Resident Evil, as another quick little tangent, I'm really excited to see what they're going to do with Resident Evil 7. And I think that's like the first time in like a really long time I'm excited about a Resident Evil game.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. If I don't know, maybe it's because I'm old, but it just feels really weird to keep on getting sequels to games that happened almost 20 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about Final Fantasy earlier, too. Now, I guess for me to wrap up this section, again, as someone who follows mostly from mechanics, I don't have too many like storytelling examples for me. I would say the only game that I think I felt really like brought down, probably like the original BioShock. And that was during the era where every game had to have a good and evil ending to it. And it just didn't work for me.
Well, and especially since you could have just ended the story after the meme with Andrew Ryan and it would have been fine.
Mm-hmm. And then it just went on and on. Then you fall like a 20-foot-tall naked guy, like naked bronze guy, as like your final battle.
Basically Seth from Street Fighter 4.
Yeah. Let's see. There's anything else for storytelling? I think that is about it. In fact, all right. So far, we've had a really great cast. So we'll move on to our final topic. And this is one that Michael suggested. And that is talking about, about the challenges of basically preserving our game industry, or preserving the industry itself. This is a topic we talked about last year. It was like around the time of the ESA versus, I forget the other group, EF something. I'll find the podcast and I'll link that in the podcast notes below. But since that last cast, things have certainly not have gotten better in terms of preserving the video game industry. It has always been a hassle. Like, this actually goes back to what we talked about earlier in this cast with Atlus. Again, during the early thousands, Atlus made very limited runs of their games. Now, you know, it was a happy ending that they did blow up and they were able to re-release a lot of them. But if they didn't do that, and you want to try and find those games again, pretty much it would have been impossible. Unless you want to spend like $500-$600 a copy. And there really aren't a lot of places dealing with preservation. Before the cast, Michael and I briefly talked about GOG as a good example, but GOG in of itself is still a third party. Now, I think what's very interesting is how preservation is viewed by different parts of this industry. For like general consumers, I don't think they really care about preserving their games.
Oh, of course not.
And like, this is what we also talk about as one of the biggest roadblocks. And then the other issue is that it's hard to find or know about a lot of these places unless you already know. Like, I spoke with James like a few weeks ago, and I don't think you didn't even know about what GOG was at that time, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And again, like, for like people in this industry, we're like, oh, we of course know what GOG is. You know, everyone knows that. We all know about the importance of preserving, but outside of that circle, very little information exists. Like, a few years ago, I was surprised to hear that a lot of people still didn't know what Steam was, and this was around, like, 2010, 2009 kind of thing. And again, for people like us, we obviously know what Steam is, we use it every day. But just like with game preservation, it's one of those topics that the larger market as a whole really doesn't know about or really doesn't care. So, since you brought up the topic, Michael, what are your thoughts sort of on like this issue of game preservation?
Like you said before, the general public by and large doesn't care about preserving their games and all that. But like I said earlier in the cast, if you want to be a game designer and want to look at old games, for inspiration or study or whatever, mm-hmm. you'll find a treasure trove of PC games with GOG and Steam and all that. Mm-hmm. But on the console side, it's suspect at best.
Yes.
And what really got my goat about it was a few years ago when like the Xbox One was first announced, and it was talking about how it was originally supposed to be a DRM console.
Yeah.
and the whole discussion came up of how why do PC games get away with DRM and stuff like that. And one of the things brought up was that you have a PS3, PS4 comes out, you buy the PS4, and it doesn't transfer the games you bought on the PSN. So you have a ton of indie games or classics that are going nowhere, just nowhere. And of course, not everything lasts forever and stuff like that. But and out of all the console ones, the PSN's probably the best one so far, aside from not having an alphabetized function. Mm-hmm. Just troublesome.
Yeah.
Xbox Live, you can just forget about it. Mm-hmm. There's barely anything, and especially, yeah. And the eShop is a little better, but still needs work. And it's even and by and large, it's getting worse now with the omission of the backwards compatibility.
Yeah.
And it just drives me up a wall.
Yeah,
as you can hear.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and all really good points, Michael. And again, the game industry, this is something, a topic I keep coming back to on these casts, but we are really horrible at preserving and having credible sources of information, especially about our history and about how game design really works.
Yeah, the freaking Epic of Gilgamesh that was like carved in a stone like thousands of years BC ago. You just read it online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like with the preservation side of things, again, it's very hard. Like, we could spend easily another hour just talking about all the different problems that go into it. But for people trying to preserve things, it's also a pain in the ass. We mentioned this off recording, but there, like, the whole process for playing one of these older games is a feat in and of itself. If I want to watch an old movie, it's as easy as finding it on the computer, finding a DVD, 1, 2, 3, I'm done. Same thing, yeah, with a book, same thing with looking up classic art. If I want to get a game to play, like, if I want to play Solar Jetman for Nintendo, I mean, good luck with, you know, getting every little piece. It's sort of like an Indiana Jones quest. You need to get all the necessary components together to get that to work. Earlier in 2015, I spoke with Alex Handy, who runs the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment, which mm-hmm. is a museum that basically caters towards preserving these video games. And, like, he's one of, like, the few people, I think one of, like, the few places, if not the only place in the United States that is, you know, focused on being a place to preserve these systems and stuff. And even he talked about the problems that he has to have. Like, he has, like, 20, he's, like, 30, 40 different Sega Genesis. You know, like, if one breaks, he can swap that out. But, you know, what happens when he runs out of Sega Genesis? Again, as you just said, Michael, technology has a limited lifespan, both by the consumer and just by its own limitations. Like, the Nintendo Entertainment System was not designed to work 100 years from now.
No, of course not. And I know that porting and preserving is lots and lots of work. I try not to be too hyperbolic about it. Mm-hmm. But, ugh.
Yeah. The problem, once again, is the fact that you can store video games as easy as you can books or movies. Again, with a DVD, it takes up very little space. Now, of course, if you're a gamer and you have, like, I used to have, like, 57 CD cases behind me, it gets a little tricky. But it's not as bad as, again, if I want to play a Super Nintendo game, but hell, that's a perfect example. I still have my Super Nintendo sort of in a Frankenstein-esque hookup behind my HD TV. And, like, it's a pain in the ass to run. I even have an original 3DO that I haven't managed to hook up yet. Because, again, it's such a hassle trying to get all this to work. And here's, like, the big point. I know, as someone who's a game designer, I'm sure you're going to share this frustration with me as well, Michael, is the fact that there's a lot of great classic games. When I interviewed GOG, we talked about this. The game design philosophy has changed so much in the last 30 years. So games back then literally could not be made these days just due to the change in design and philosophy. But despite that, it's becoming harder and harder to appreciate and study those games.
Yep.
Now, I want to turn this over to you, James, to ask your thoughts, because, again, you weren't here when I last spoke about this about a year ago. And, again, as someone who grew up playing video games, your interest in the industry now, what are your thoughts on sort of this issue of game preservation?
Well, I do believe that you're seeing a little bit of a comeback. I mean, it's not much. Mm-hmm.
They are remaking System Shock 1 now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the remake of stuff, too, but you also have, GameStop has just started selling and taking in older titles that they weren't doing several years ago. You have a lot of, independent video game stores that mostly deal in older games. There's a video game store about 15 minutes away from me that has a whole wall. I mean, you guys, Josh, you'd love the. I should send you a picture sometime. It's literally just his entire store. The upper part of the walls, all of the four walls, is covered with a lineage of everything video game in order from the Jaguar, the Atari, all the way up to PS4. And he even has a Nintendo section. So there are those few who keep the old stories alive. but as far as like making that mainstream, I do agree with you. I think it's becoming, it has been hard. Now I do know Nintendo brushes off things if it knows it can make money, like with the increase of Pokemon, and the continuation of the Pokemon fan base. Nintendo has re-released, Red, Blue, and Yellow from their vaults, and you can now download the original games on your 3DS.
Mm-hmm.
They actually are compatible with some of the newer games. So, which, I keep in mind, yes, I mean, in the grand span of video game history,
I'm not trying to say things are not getting any better. They are.
Yeah, but it's very slow. Mm-hmm. And I can even say too slow. Yeah, I do believe. Yeah, I think something really does need to happen. I'd love to see something like GOG get a license with Sony or
Nintendo
or Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
Nintendo's not going to budge. Nintendo is going to hold on to their properties until it's 2015.
but just think, if they made their own big box anthology stuff. Anthology of their games, like from like NES to like a big giant greatest hits.
Yeah.
We probably see a lot more of this stuff, but them's the breaks.
Mm-hmm. I think reverse it though. I think, and I'm calling this from just the history of Nintendo. If you see Sony and Microsoft start upping their purchase of these old licenses, buying the code, buying the licenses, and putting them up on their stores, like you see an influx, Nintendo will follow suit. They will. They have to.
Yeah.
Because they'll realize, oh crap, this is making these guys money. We got to do it to compete.
Yeah.
I don't think Nintendo's going to budge until it sees its competitors.
Yeah, now, the only problem with that, and this is where I guess the pessimist in me takes over, is that I just don't see Sony or Microsoft willing to put in the dedicated effort to do that when they can pitch, you know, the latest Call of Duty or the latest Halo or stuff like that.
Especially in the age of disposability and most people my generation are like, gimme now.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to sort of the issue with educating the consumer. Again, the second the new console comes out, a lot of people are conditioned just to, you know, throw out their old stuff because, you know, new stuff, new, better graphics, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
But, I mean, that's sort of like how technology in most areas are. You know, after the iPhone 4 comes out, who cares about the iPhone 3 or the iPhone 2, et cetera, et cetera.
But, right.
But it's such a... But the thing is, with the video game industry, we are very much a combination of art and product. There is worth in, you know, having the original Mario or playing Final Fantasy III. And on our cast last year, we talked about how you really can't, unfortunately, you can't rely on Nintendo, Sony, or Microsoft. You can't just have one company be the quote-unquote gatekeeper for the stuff. And I think the only way for things to really take off and improve is there needs to be a way to get like a third party, someone like GOG, who can handle this stuff from the outside. They don't care. They're not caring too much about modern games in the sense that they don't, on GOG, they don't need to push modern titles other than the ones they publish. They are there to, again, cater to this audience of enthusiasts and collectors who want these older games. But I guess the big question and the big concerning point is there someone who could become a third party for console games? I don't think there is. I think that's the problem.
Yeah, the follow-up question. Who can?
And who
exactly would want to go into that business? I mean, granted, you do have an advantage because... You go into that side, you don't have any competitors, so at least there's that. But getting the code and assets and all that is probably much harder for console games than it is for PC.
Yes.
Because at least with GOG, most of the old games on there are like old DOS games that haven't been played for decades or talked about by the game industry by and large.
Mm-hmm.
because also easy to forget, 16 years ago, and at least until 2007, consoles were king. Consoles were on top of the world.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention the fact that another part of this, during that period, like early, I would say late 80s, early 90s, so again, like 2000, probably 2008, 2009, maybe even a little later than that, the console PC divide was absolute. You weren't seeing console games on the PC the same way you would see PC games on the console. Everything was very much self-contained. And it took a lot in terms of standardization of game pads and philosophy to really elicit that change. But even then, there are still exceptions to that rule. Like, I don't think we're ever going to see, like, the latest Anno game on the PlayStation 4. But interestingly, we're seeing Don't Starve on PS4, so who knows? Maybe I'll be proven wrong soon on that front.
Well, and I honestly think that things like that, and that's where maybe I have a little bit more bright-eyed youth optimism that, you know, with the introduction of, I won't say introduction, but the real big push of independent titles being released on PlayStation and on Xbox, you're seeing they're getting sold. People are playing these games. So I mean, to other people, I say I don't think people know what the console gamers are going to do until you give them something. Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? It's like, who'd have thought that a game like that a game like Don't Starve would be a hit on console? You know what I mean? It's like you don't know until you actually you know dangle the bait.
Mm-hmm.
And you see who comes jumping.
And to be the marketer in this conversation, it's playing the game is that you have to find out what the customer wants. But the trick is, they don't know that they want it. Yeah.
And again, it goes back to properly educating people. Again, like a lot of people go, why should I play Final Fantasy VI when Final Fantasy XV is coming out? Who the hell cares about that? Like,
Well, to that, sir, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah. And it's just, again, sort of like that divide between the art and the product. Now, another part of this problem, one that I talked about a few minutes ago when I spoke with Alex Handy of The Maid, again, is that the technology. Like, there is no console ever developed that can easily run Nintendo games and PlayStation 1 games and Sega Saturn and TurboGrafx, etc. The technology is just too different. Again, this is what they did back during those days. Everyone was basically doing their own unique thing because everyone wanted to become the standard. It's why during the late 80s to early 2000s, everybody had their own different gamepad design. You know, the Sega Genesis was completely different from Nintendo. Nintendo was completely different from 3DO, etc. But the problem with that, again, is trying to make something that can actually support this stuff. I read an article around the time that I did that podcast about the difficulties of effectively emulating these games. Because a lot of people thought virtual emulation would be, like, you know, the saving grace. But for each stronger or each more powerful console, the computer and the hardware needed to properly emulate that. The power just magnifies extremely. Like, I think I've read that the hardware literally doesn't exist today that could properly, I think, emulate, I think it was either PlayStation 1 or N64 era game. No, PlayStation 1 or PlayStation 2 era games at the moment. And I don't know if the technology will ever be there, because again, going back to what you were just saying, Michael Garland, like the marketing side, is there a market? Like, will we ever know there's a market for people willing to preserve these games?
Well, what about the, I mean, let's say it, but what about, like, the hacking community? I mean, dude, you can put, I've openly admit it, but I've messed around with the PSP code, and you can put different things on run it on the PSP. Like, and people are playing emulators on their phones.
Yeah.
For a lot of these other a lot of the old school systems, just that the personal people that want to just have a throwback to some of the older games. Yeah. So, I mean, I think the technology is there. Now, is the drive there? That'll definitely agree with you.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about that, Michael? About whether the market really is there or not?
You know, I'm also a pessimist like you, but I still like to think there might be, but I swear this will be the last movie analogy I'll bring up. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this label outlet called the Criterion Collection. Mm-hmm. That their market is specified toward cinephiles only. You do get some recent films in there, like so recent as like Wes Anderson's Fantastic Mr. Fox stop motion movie. Mm-hmm. It mostly markets itself to cinephiles with like Akira Kurosawa, who inspired George Lucas with Seven Samurai and stuff like that. Ingmar Bergman and other out there foreign art house stuff and a lot of the overlooked in the games and to bring up a metaphor, stuff like Terranigma, maybe also Suikoden 2, and all the overlooked overlooked cult classics that are must play games now. And like your example, Rule of the Rose might be in that category too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, it's sort of interesting to have these discussions. Like, I find, again, I get to feel old at the same time, but I do find fun. Like, we talk about games like Final Fantasy VI or Dragon Warrior, even like Rule of Rose. I think it's not even 10 years old yet, although I could be wrong by this point. But we're talking about these games as these, like, lost, ancient, you know, classics, you know, like the same thing as, like, old, rare books or movies. And again, like, it goes back to what we said at the start, that the video game industry moves so rapidly that it does feel like that way. Again, like Nintendo, when we think about this, the Super Nintendo really is only, at this point, a little over 25 years about old. But there's still people driving cars, you know, there's still like with a classic car market, there's people driving cars from like 1940, 1950 today. And there's still interest in that. Now, while a car is obviously different from a video game, but I think I do sort of lean towards you a little bit, James, regarding, I think there is interest in this. The challenge, though, is finding someone who can do this and figuring out that market. Because obviously, the people who are into classic games, you know, like a console version of GOG, that market's going to be way smaller compared to people who are interested in the latest Call of Duty or the latest Blizzard game, etc. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not that exists, I think we need to find that sooner than later. Because again, every year that goes by, these games become harder and harder to keep playing.
Right. Another solution might be is some technology or other or some way that porting these games becomes cheaper. Mm-hmm. You know, the more on the development side.
Yeah, definitely. All right, I think it is time to wrap things up. We're approaching the hour and a half mark. One last thing before I go into my usual end of cast speech and all that. For anyone listening to this cast who's had experience with emulating games or the challenges of trying to get this to work, I would love to talk to you either via an email interview or having its own separate podcast to talk specifically about sort of the ins and outs of game emulation from that point of view. Again, if you want to reach out to me, there is the Contact Us page, or you can send me an email at josh@game-wisdom.com. But, again, this is one of those topics, I keep saying this, but these topics just don't have easy answers. And I think this is going to be another one, sort of like our one last week regarding game reselling, that is not going to go away anytime soon. So, before we say goodnight, I'm going to turn the floor to each of you. Do you have any final thoughts or closing statements, you know, either on storytelling or game preservation or just anything at all that you would like to say? And Michael, since you're the guest, we'll start with you.
All right. Well, both topics have a long, long, slow climb upwards. Mm-hmm. That's my closing statement.
Okay. James?
I don't think like I said, I have a lot of faith in the gaming industry and its fans. And I think in the end, I think more fans will realize how important a lot of fans are going to realize how important not just old games are, but because of storytelling, which is funny because that's what the cast is about, a lot of these old games really did focus on story, mm-hmm. and those are stories that aren't easily forgotten.
All right, great words to end on. So, with all that said, we are going to end things here for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you would like to support Game Wisdom or follow us, there are multiple ways to do that. First, if you'd like to be a guest on a future podcast or write a guest piece for the site, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. As for guests, I am always looking for people interested in talking about the game industry or design. You can be student, enthusiast, developer, whoever. As long as you like talking about it, we'd love to have you on. Be sure to subscribe on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer to get the latest updates when content goes live, as well as random thoughts from me throughout the day on Twitter. You can also find our video content on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, as well as nightly streams on Twitch. There are links to both on the front page. There you'll be able to find the wide variety of video content, including examinations, analysis, and let's plays. Lastly, for the Patreon side of things, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom that way, you can find us on Patreon under Game Wisdom. Any donations would be greatly appreciated. They allow me to keep the site going while supporting myself. You can get some great rewards that way, and if we can hit some of the goals I have set up, we can add even more content for you to enjoy. Right now, we're currently offering a digital CD for pledges of $20 or more. That will get you the collection of this month's casts, all nicely stored on Dropbox for you, as well as a commentary track from me. And for 15 and up, I like to now offer a special shout out to those who've been donating. So, very quickly, we have Danny Ramdas and King Isaac Lynx, who have $20 pledges on Patreon. If you like your own shout out, be sure to check out the Patreon campaign. So, with all that said, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.